Turn the page. It's the bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. And today we're discussing Expect the Unexpected. Today's show is called Bet You Never Saw That Coming. And it's all about the books with surprising twists and turns, the ones that keep you guessing. I'm going to start with a book that I've been raving to everybody about. Everyone in the studio has had it pressed into their hands. And it's a book called Yesteryear. Honestly, it is one of the most mind-bending reading experiences I have had in a long time. When I finished this book, my head was spinning and I felt stunned and deeply shaken, but also so impressed by a book that offered deep questions, but also entertained me and kept me hooked. It's the 2026 debut novel by Caro Claire Burke that follows a trad wife influencer who wakes up in 1855, and it blends satire and suspense and social commentary. By way of background, just to give you an idea, you may not have heard of the term trad wife. It's a kind of conflated term that puts traditional and housewife into one word. It's the modern-day housewife who embraces traditional gender roles, typically focusing on homemaking, on childcare, on supporting her husband, often while sharing an idealized lifestyle on social media. And the movement, it's a huge trend. The movement has gained significant traction across social media platforms, and influencers amassing millions of followers by vividly portraying these glamorous, traditional, domestic lifestyles. Now, of course, there is huge discussion about trad wives, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Researchers are arguing that the glamorization of domesticated roles for women is less about a genuine embrace of traditional roles and more a plea from the younger generation reflecting what they describe as the impossible balance demanded by modern work and family life, which so many women face. Of course, it has sparked huge debate. And this book touches on that. It does many, many other things as well. Based on the blurb, the premise of Yesteryear reads like a kind of time travel fantasy blended with women's fiction. We meet Natalie Heller Mills. She is a glossy, picture-perfect YouTuber and influencer, documenting an idyllic farm life with her husband and five children, and she's got another one on the way. And one morning, she wakes up in the same house, but she is no longer in this beautifully modern, renovated farmhouse that glamorizes the olden days. She is in 1805, surrounded by dirt, by hardship, by firewood for heat, hand-washed clothes, poverty, and a rougher, older version of her husband. There's no electricity, no comfort, no safety net. It's brutal pioneer reality. And at first, it feels like a nightmare she wants to wake up from. And I assumed that the story would follow a kind of straightforward, magical, kind of historical fantasy path. But the blurb is only one layer of the book. The central mystery actually surrounds or revolves around why Natalie, who is a devout Christian, manic pixie-style trad wife with 8 million followers, becomes the target of angry online critics, of Ivy League elites, of social media activists who label her as anti-feminist. And so she's kind of trapped in a little house on the prairie kind of imagined life, and she needs to figure out how to survive and whether she can return to real life. Interwoven, we get to know about Natalie. We learn about her scholarship to Harvard, how she struggles because of her strict moral values that clash with the world of students. Her motto is to always be nice, but underneath there's like rage and resentment simmering beneath the surface. And we meet Caleb. When she meets Caleb, he's from a large conservative patriarchal family with secrets of their own, but she realizes soon that he's actually intellectually lazy, he's spoiled, he's completely disconnected. And when she suggests starting a farm as a project, she thinks she's helping him and finding purpose, you know, being a good wife, good supportive wife. But in the end, it becomes her own empire, complete with millions of followers and brand deals and hired nannies. This book is a fascinating and chilling reflection obviously it's on the continuum, but you know, for those of us who have lovely, neat suburban lives, it really did ask questions about traditional roles of what makes a good wife, what makes a good husband. In our context, that is certainly a conversation to be had, and I think that it's changed over time. Societal expectations of what is so-called right. We've all been socialized, which of course is a good and right thing, I think. But with social media and the modern world, I think some of it has crossed a line. So I want to read you a little bit that really resonated with me, because I'm a good girl, and I'm sure many listeners listening to this will know what that means. I'm, you know, probably good girls and good boys themselves. And so this is Natalie talking to her daughter, who is watching her film one of her, you know, most perfect days as she makes sourdough bread from wheat that she got from the farm. You know, it's all perfect. And her daughter, Cassidy, turns to her and says, "Mama, I turned around. Clementine was standing in the doorway, 6 years old, gripping her blankie tightly with one fist. Dark eyes, mouth small and pink as a rosebud. 'What are you doing, Mama?' The Zoom call had ended. It was late at night. Caleb was down in the office nearby the barn, sitting in front of the computer, and I, well, I'm practicing being likable." Clementine walked over to the mirror, peered at her own reflection, and said, "What's likable?" I positioned her in front of me so that we were looking at each other in the mirror. For the millionth time, I found myself startled at how similar we looked, down to the scowl. A little minnow of irritation swam through me. "You have no clue how you look to others. You're a big girl now, Clementine. You need to learn to smile." "Why?" I resisted the very strong urge to press my fingers into the clay of her cheeks and drag the ends of her lips upwards. "Because it makes other people feel safe and warm and loved. Don't you want to make other people feel safe and warm and loved?" She hesitated and then nodded. "Well, then try it. Try to smile." She tried. She looked terrible. "That's close. But it needs to reach your eyes, like this." And then I showed her what I had learned. Learning to smile and how to be a good girl. The final twist is wild. It's a little far-fetched, but it is devastating. And this hook is such a killer hook that Anne Hathaway allegedly bought film rights, having only seen a draft of the book. I inhaled this book in 48 hours. It's uncomfortable, it's brilliant, and it's unforgettable. After the break, we are going to be chatting to Sally Cranswick, whose powerful novel of All Things We Need Hope takes readers on another different but also mind-bending journey. It's perfect for this episode of Bookmark. Bet you never saw that coming. So let me know, when you read a novel, do you want the end to unfold just as you hoped, or do you love having the rug pulled out from under you? I would love to know. Expected ending or a surprise? Let me know on 061-895-1019.
Turn the page. It's the Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and today we are looking at books with unexpected endings. It's under the title of Bet You Never Saw That Coming. And just before I welcome and chat to our author, a shout out to Linda, who says she loves a surprise, except when someone you really want to love dies at the end. I hear you. I stopped reading Harry Potter after Dumbledore died. I just actually couldn't carry on. And Austin, an even bigger shout out to you. You were my very first fan for the show, and I know that you love it. You said to me that the show is a rock in your calendar, and I was delighted to meet you in person at a book launch this week. Sally Cranswick's new novel, Of All Things We Need Hope, has themes of grief, of forgiveness. It asks questions about restorative justice, about motherhood, and it had me hooked. This was the kind of book I gulped in two sittings. It was one of those where I said to the family, look, you know, just sort out your own supper. I'm busy. So it fits right in with this bookmark episode. And Sally, a very warm welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Batya. Thanks very much for having me along.
Sally is a writing coach and a creative mentor, but she's also a writer herself. She's a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Cape Town, and she has spent decades helping others find their stories, but obviously also quietly crafting her own. Sally, we're delighted to have you. Sally and I are going to have a conversation, but we're going to tiptoe around the spoilers because we cannot spoil this book. So if we sort of hit dead ends or dead silences, you know why.
It's become the book tour of not talking about my
yes,
book.
Yes, exactly. But Sally, I think the premise of this book is extraordinary because it begins with an unimaginable context. It's a mother whose child is murdered, her son is murdered, and she chooses to befriend the young man in jail who murdered her son. So it's the kind of premise that stops you in your tracks. Where did this idea first come from, and what was it about this question that wouldn't let go?
The answer is quite long, so I'm going to try and make it sort of a snappy answer for you. But really, I think that the initial premise came, this idea for this book came with the idea of a mother's journey, you know, what that involves and how people don't really understand what that is along the way. There are so many things that mothers do that they never say. And, you know, as a writer, I actually take ideas from all over the place. And then suddenly there'll be some one moment in time where everything crystallizes and your story comes together. So, you know, there are news reports on things going on around you. I absorb those. There's the idea of a mother's journey. That comes into it. I absorb that. And then actually just recently I've been decluttering all my writing. And I found out, you know, back in the old days when I used to keep newspaper clippings, I'd actually from 30 years ago kept newspaper clippings on people that had relationships with people in prison. And I had forgotten actually that I'd done that. So it really just goes to show that, yeah, you have many ideas along the way. Then something sets you on the journey, and all those other things that have informed you suddenly come into the story. So that's the short answer.
It reminds me of, you know, how you always say to young people starting a job that 30 years of experience takes 30 years to get. And yeah. I kind of feel like even though this is, I think, your second book, that's years and years of collecting stories of a story percolating, right?
Definitely story percolating, yeah, for all that time. And I always talk about it like, you remember those stereogram pictures from the 80s where the, you know, you have all those pixels and then suddenly the dinosaur jumps out at you.
Yes.
And that's very much for me what a story's like. It's all in there and then it's, you know,
and then suddenly
out.
It's very much there. Yes. Well, as a reader, I left with so many questions. As I read the book, I had more and more questions, and it really put into question my own moral compass, what I consider to be right and wrong. It made me question my judgments, though, you know, like, do you snap to judgment? Did you intend to, you know, get readers on this questioning journey?
Yes, I mean, well, I say yes. You know, you were just talking about, do you like a book with a plot twist? And I like a book that makes me think something different, shift my point of view, see something from another side. And so when I'm writing, I never seek to specifically say something, but I do like to ask questions of myself on that journey as well. And I think that's where that comes from. It's like, what am I thinking as well? And the idea of working with a character just offers you such rich opportunity to ask those questions.
In the story, Heather's husband, her friends, her family are understandably outraged and appalled by what they see as Heather's desecration of her late son's memory by befriending and really looking after his murderer. Mm. It seems inexplicable. And slowly but surely, she alienates and loses every single person in her life. And my question, of course, as the reader was, oh, well, do they alienate and lose her? Did it happen that way around? And to be honest, as the reader, I found myself judging her behavior as unhealthy, as obsessive, just like many other characters in the book. Do you think that we as a society still consider a right and wrong way to grieve, a right and wrong way to get through difficult things? You know, that medicating is fine, but lashing out is not. You know, we criticize Victorian generations for such strict rules, but I'm not sure we're free of that. What do you think?
That's a really interesting, I mean, it's a big question, but, you know, there is, I mean, the one thing I do know is that grief is different for everybody, and it's not a linear journey. And, you know, people get through it any way they can. And this woman, I really like what you just said, was she shunned them, but actually did they shun her? Because it was very much, in fact, she did try to turn to people and tell them what she wanted to do. And they were so shocked that she would do this that they immediately shut her down and turned her away. And so she just got on with this journey on her own. And I think there's a moment in there when I actually say, if her husband had just hugged her and accepted her, perhaps everything would have been different. You know, it's that acceptance, that love.
Yeah, that's not a simple answer, and it still leaves me with questions because, you know, I think that we do have a sense of what is a healthy way to mourn, to grieve, to get over difficult things, and what is unhealthy. But that comes
with the idea that we don't know what people are thinking. I think that's the other thing. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
But they didn't actually know what she was thinking at all along on that journey, and through their own refusal to engage with her. So people might be grieving terribly. You know, people just walking around past us, you don't know what they're going through. They might be grieving terribly, but not showing it.
Yeah. And I think that idea of that there are right and wrong ways of doing things permeates a whole range of things, from very important things like how do you grieve, how do you get over a difficult thing, how do you love, to the smaller things. And this really got me thinking. It's on page 164, and it's talking about Heather. She's on this journey. She's been alienated, or she has alienated everyone she cares about, and she's living on her own. And it says she poured hot water over coffee powder. She no longer bothered with the ritual of making fresh coffee in a French press or even warming milk. She just stirred a spoon of sugar into black coffee and thought about all the hours, the days, and months she must have spent making the perfect coffee, when really this would have been just fine all along. And it got me thinking about my own life and how I've made a big deal. I mean, it's lovely, you know, to celebrate making a cup of coffee, but really, maybe just stirring some sugar into black coffee is just fine.
I've just had a week of doing that. I mean, I make a big ceremony with my coffee. I love my coffee, and I've just had a week away on a farm, and there was Nescafe, and there was no milk, and there was sugar. You know, and it did just fine.
It was really fine. And here you are. Yeah. You've survived.
Yeah, exactly. Still here to tell the story.
The novel spans decades, and it explores how grief changes over time. We often imagine grief as something that you get over, but your book suggests something a little different. What did writing about Heather teach you about that long life of grief?
Some deep questions here for a Friday morning.
We're only just starting.
I think something I've sort of learned with Heather and subsequent to Heather's journey as well on my own journeys, you know, grief becomes something that you have to live with. It doesn't go. And I think, in fact, I was just chatting to somebody this morning about it in a different context. And she lost her mother 4 years ago and is still carrying the grief very deeply, because it never goes. You just learn to walk with it. I think that's the thing. You learn how to live alongside of it is what I've learned. Because it's stuff, with other things that happen in your life, you might get over them and the situation changes and this has happened and now you've moved on. But you can't move on from grief. It happens. Somebody's died in your life, you've lost someone. And so therefore, you can't make that better, but you can walk alongside it.
Yeah, it's kind of holding a whole lot of things. I wanted to talk about hope because that's the title of All Things We Need Hope. Do you think that's true?
I do. I mean, I love the idea of hope. And since, in fact, since the book's come out, I'm getting all these wonderful messages and WhatsApps and emails and calls about hope, quotes of hope. And it was the last thing left in Pandora's box. And of all things, we need hope. I mean, you've got to have hope, haven't you?
Yeah, it's.
I love the word.
I think so, and I think what the book shows is about hope not being something passive, but actually something quite radical that you have to choose.
Yes, because I think people might criticize the word hope for being a passive thing. If you just hope for something, but if
Yes.
you can hope for it, if you can visualize it, if you can bring it into your life and your hemisphere, you can maybe manifest it.
I recently listened to, I'm a fan of Brené Brown, and she has a podcast with Adam Grant called The Curiosity Shop, which I highly recommend, by the way, if anyone is interested in Brené Brown. And they were talking about one of the topics was hope is not a strategy, and we all know that. But what she did kind of unpack was how hope is a background that then facilitates strategy and
Yes,
informs
that's an excellent way of
strategy.
looking.
And I thought that was an excellent way of looking at it, and I buy
Hope,
that.
hope is your easy entry into that.
Yes.
It's your sort of, it's your soft launch into the next moment, isn't it?
Before this novel, you wrote short stories. Your book, Woman Out of Water, was about women who find themselves displaced in extraordinary circumstances. And I think Heather is just a long story of one of those. Did it feel like that?
It actually did, yes. In fact, in that collection of short stories, Women Out of Water, the first story there is called Horse. And I had always thought at the beginning that that was going to be a novel, but it ended up being like a long story, I suppose, about 15,000 words. But yeah, I never, when I start a story, I leave it a little bit open to length. Sometimes it might just be 500 words, 15,000. This is actually quite a, of all things we need hope, is actually quite a short novel at 55,000 words. So that's why I think you said you read it in two sittings. A lot of people are contacting me and saying they read it in one sitting,
You
and
can.
so that's actually the nicer thing about a short novel. It can be one experience. But yes, all of those stories, Women Out of Water, about women in circumstances and situations that are extreme. And then how do they cope? How do they get out? How do they get through it, over it, out of it,
Why
or
do you
not?
think these stories keep calling to you?
Interesting question. And I think since I was 16, I mean, it's Women Out of Water. Obviously, the title is a play on fish out of water. But, as soon as I turned 16, really, I was ready to travel the world and see what was going on outside of my own front door. So I've often been a fish out of water myself. And so I guess maybe it stems from that.
I like that, fish out of water. I actually didn't make that connection. It's interesting. Now it's gonna make me now just rethink the book
Okay,
and the
that's where it came
stories.
from.
You've also spent years helping other writers find their voices. Talk to us about the writing process. Was it very different, you writing as opposed to coaching other writers? Did you learn things that you never knew on the other side?
Again, another interesting question. I mean, these are the two books I've had published, but I do have a lot in my bottom drawer of manuscripts as well.
I wouldn't, I'm
I mean,
sure.
because I mean, the whole idea with writing is that the writing is in the practice. You've just got to write. So I'm running a course at the moment for UCT, and it's called Write a Novel That Sparkles. And this week, everybody's writing their throwaway chapter one because you can't, it's you. And I've said, write it and then throw it away. This is just your throwaway chapter one, just to get into the story, to find your entry point. So for me, Everything that you write is worth writing. There's no throw, there's nothing that doesn't come back and help you in some way. You've just got to sit down and do the work, but not think of it as work, sit down and do the writing.
Did you
Does
have a
I've forgotten what your
throwaway?
question was already.
Did you have a throwaway chapter for this book?
I actually had a lot of throwaway first paragraphs for this book. So I knew what I want, this is often the way with the stories. I knew exactly what I wanted to write, but it's finding that vehicle, that entry into the story. And so then I had a lot of paragraphs like, where does the story like this start? Does it start in the courtroom? Does it start in the prison? Does it start at the beginning? Does it start at the end? And then all of a sudden, those, I was in the shower, it always happens in the shower. And then this was what came to me. It was one of those bright, uncomplicated Cape days. The sun shone high in a sky blue sky without a cloud overhead. And I jumped out the shower and I wrote that line down. That's the first line of the book. And I thought, that's it. That's the entry into the book. I know where exactly where it's going from here.
It's so interesting to write your own and do your own work when you're preaching to everybody else and kind of making it look really easy. Is it easy? Is it easy to write now that you spend so much time teaching? Is it easy to listen to your own advice?
I think you've got to, I love your word preach, you've got to practice what you preach. You've got to, I like to say, I've got to walk the talk, is it? Or talk the walk, yeah. In fact, my writing has, I mean, I do a lot of writing. I'm now in my third year PhD of a creative writing PhD, and it has, my entry into stories has become much easier and much more fluid. And I'm also better at spotting what's a workable story, what's a good story, what's a publishable story, all those sorts of things as well. But the other thing is to say that everything I've written, when it's written and you hold the book, it's like, yes, that was a breeze. I just sat down and I wrote that book. That was so easy. Gosh, next. But in fact, if I really remember back, on that, it was scene to scene to scene. What would she do now? What informs the story? How do I draw the thread together? But it's always, with hindsight, it was always easy to write.
Well, it's very easy to read. I can say that. Not easy, not easy to sit with, and the questions that it will leave you with are not comfortable. Of all things, We Need Hope by Sally Cranswick is available at all good bookstores. I've got a copy here and I have a line when I get out of the studio of people who want it. There's a queue for the book because it is our book of the week and I'll be pressing it into somebody's hand and it's going to be passed
Thank
on.
you.
Sally, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much indeed. It's lovely to be here.
Turn the page. It's the bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Brekker, and this is 101.9 High FM's show dedicated to books and the people who love them. Today's show is called Bet You Never Saw That Coming, and it's all about the books with surprising twists and turns, the ones that keep you guessing. Bianca, thank you for your comments. I know you prefer not to be shocked by the outcome of books because you become kind of so engrossed in the story and you want good things to happen. You don't want anything to add but end badly, and I totally get that. I also like your comment about trad wives and traditional wives and the mindset that goes with it. It's such a complicated issue, probably the topic for an entirely different show. What is your reading style? Do you enjoy the satisfaction of an ending you can see coming? Or are you happiest when a book completely catches you off guard? Expected ending or surprise ending? Let me know on 061-895-1019. I have a couple more books with gulp-worthy twists to share with you. The first is We Begin at the End by Chris Whitaker. This is not Chris Whitaker's newest book. His newest one you may know is All the Colors of the Dark. But We Begin at the End has a kind of similar feel. His novels have been translated into 31 languages and won all kinds of crime novel awards of the year. And so We Begin at the End, I think, is the strongest. Right, wrong, life is seldom one or the other, and life is often lived somewhere in between. We meet Duchess Day Radley. She's a 13-year-old self-proclaimed outlaw. and Rules Are for Other People. She's a fierce protector of her 5-year-old brother, Robin, and really the parent to her mother, Star, who's a single mom who's pretty much incapable of taking care of herself, let alone her 2 kids. We also meet Walk. He has never left the coastal Californian town where he and Star grew up. He has become the chief of police, but he's still trying to heal an old wound regarding his best friend, Vincent King, who has spent decades in prison. And he is, of course, in overdrive, protecting Duchess and her little brother, Robin. So now, 30 years later, Vincent is being released from prison, and Duchess and Walk must face the trouble that comes with his return. We Begin at the End is an extraordinary novel. It's about 2 kinds of families. It's about the ones we're born into and the ones we create. And I don't want to give more away, but I do want to recommend that you read it. Read it for the broken characters. Read it for the unforgettable Duchess, the loyal Walk, the long-suffering Vincent King, the resentful Star, the fiery Martha, and the angry Hal, who've all been putting off living for 30 years. Read it for the little traumatized Robin and the loyal best friend, Thomas Noble, and Dolly with her flat chest. And you might even read it for the villains, Dark, Milton, and Brandon. It's poetic, it's heart-wrenching, and there is a jaw-dropping, heartfelt conclusion. When I asked a couple of listeners and readers for books that have surprised them, this came up. It's called Broken Country by Claire Leslie Hall. And it's won, I think, the awards that really make all the difference because they are chosen by readers. It's the Goodreads Choice Awards, and it has been nominated for Favorite Historical Fiction. It's been nominated for Favorite Audiobook. And this is the story of Beth, her gentle, kind husband, Frank. They're happily married, but the relationship relies on the past staying buried. And then Beth's brother-in-law shoots a dog going after their sheep. And Beth doesn't realize that the gunshot is going to actually alter the course of their lives, because the dog belonged to none other than Gabriel Wolfe, the man that Beth loved as a teenager who broke her heart years ago. Gabriel has returned to the village with his young son, Leo, and it's a boy who reminds Beth very much of her own son, who died in a tragic accident. And so they are drawn back into each other's lives, and tensions around the village rise, and dangerous secrets and jealousies from the past resurface, this time with deadly consequences. It's a sweeping love story. There are mixed reviews, actually, when you look at the reviews, but it is a book of simmering passion, of impossible choices and explosive consequences that explore the far-reaching legacy of long-lost love. So there's a reviewer, Rachel Haynes, said, "I think this book has achieved the unachievable, to be a love story and a mystery thriller, a character-driven study while still being fast-paced, quiet and moving, but still an utter delight to read." And of course, there are unexpected surprises here. I also want to talk about Mary Watson, because Mary Watson is really interesting. Her most popular book was The Cleaner, that you may know. And this one, her newest one, is called The Lover. It offers just as much uncertainty and menace. And as you turn the pages, you kind of get further and further towards the front and edge of your seat. You never know what happens behind closed doors. Joseph Rafferty, known as Rafe, is Hallie Rausch's boss at the Moss Museum in Lomara, Ireland. He's charismatic, he's attractive, he's intelligent, and perhaps the most perfect man. One morning, Hallie wakes up next to Rafe, but to find him dead, clearly murdered during the night. And everyone, especially Rafe's ex-wife Lisa, is going to think that she did it. It's Hallie versus the court of public opinion. This is a really good psychological thriller. It brims with anxiety and uncertainty and confusion, and the tone becomes more and more ominous as the threat and danger levels rise, it becomes obvious that something is coming. But what? Who will emerge on the other side of it? It keeps me on the edge of my seat trying to get a handle on the central protagonists as the plot becomes as twisty as the Conar Pass in County Kerry. One of the greatest attributes, I think, or strengths of the novel is the atmosphere that the author creates. Central to this is the museum, which affords many opportunities to intensify that creepy vibe. The extraordinary exhibits, the off-kilter dynamics of the staff. And Mary Watson herself has experience in this. She grew up in Cape Town, where she worked as an art museum custodian, a library assistant, an actor in children's musicals, a front-of-house duty manager in the theatre, and a university lecturer. So all those are kind of have that museum feel, and she has first-hand experience in creating atmosphere and sense of place. Overall, I think it's really good. And whilst I did expect a little bit of the ending, the rest is a humdinger, and I can recommend this book.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Well, we have reached almost the end of this show. The show was dedicated to books that gave us an unexpected, surprising ending. It was called Bet You Never Saw That Coming. And we started with Yesteryear by Caro Claire Burke. And yes, it sounds like the trad wife phenomenon is something that we need to take offline and certainly unpack and have further conversation. We chatted to Sally Cranswick, the author of All Things We Need Hope. We spoke about We Begin at the End by Chris Whitaker, Broken Country by Claire Leslie Hall, and then lastly, Mary Watson's new one, The Lover. Next week's show is going to be a little bit different. It is the day after Tisha B'Av, and the day before Shabbat. So it's kind of the day after the night before, and it's an in-between show. And after Tisha B'Av, we are told that the embers of the destroyed temple continued to burn till the next day. So our next episode, that day after Tisha B'Av, we're going to be exploring what some of Judaism's thought leaders have said about Tisha B'Av. Writers, thinkers, thought leaders, from the Rambam to Sivan Rachav Meir. And we're going to explore their books, their writings, and their words that all imagine and hope for a world as a better place. And one of those people who believed so fully that we could make the world a better place was the Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem M. Schneerson. And he started the Chabad movement. He transformed Jewish outreach in his time and forever after. The letters of the Rebbe are a vast collection of over 300,000 personal and public letters written over seven decades. They cover almost every topic imaginable, from advanced Torah discussion to everyday advice on marriage, on health, on business, on personal growth. And they were published in a 30-plus volume called Igrot Kodesh, which means the Holy Letters. And the correspondence offers a unique window into the Rebbe's wisdom and his vision. And whether he was writing to a confused student, to a mother seeking parental advice, a community leader, he treated every individual's concern with deep care and practical wisdom. It's a collection of writing. Books. I mean, it's books and books of letters that have fascinated me for so long. And I'm going to be chatting to Rabbi Ari Kiveman about these letters and asking him many questions that I have surrounding them, how the volume is used today, what its relevance is today, how the Rebbe is able to speak through the written word. So I think it's going to be an interesting episode, a different episode. Tune in next week. I would love to have you listening in with me. But for now, goodbye and happy reading.